So now we want to look at a very complicated problem of statistical inference, not because I want to impress you with how clever statisticians are, but to warn you of how difficult it is to do social science. And by that I mean anything that involves people making decisions. So consider the problem of a new vaccine of unknown effectiveness. This is a very standard example in the statistical education literature, but of course it's very important to us right now in the COVID crisis. We would like to conduct an experiment to find out how well it works. We usually think of experiments as we do our experiment and we find out the answer. But it's not necessarily that easy. The problem is that there's something called the Harvard Law, which says that under the most carefully controlled conditions of temperature, pressure, and volume, the animal does whatever it pleases. And people are even worse. People will often work to get around whatever you're trying to get them to do. The problem here is that when we think of an experiment that gives us an answer just by measuring the outcome of the experiment, we're thinking of a very controlled experiment where the only causes that vary are the ones we want to vary. But in social science, there are so many causes and so many things that people can do to respond to their environment that we simply can't talk about a well-controlled experiment, not even in the case of a medical experiment with a vaccine or a new drug. So the vaccine, the standard example is that of the Sabin vaccine. And there were reasons to believe that sometimes it would be more effective than others for reasons unrelated to the treatment itself. So, for example, in a year when few people get sick, few people will catch it because there are few people to give it to them. And so that means that if you have a disease that has epidemics or outbreaks that are random and their size varies, depending on how much of an outbreak you get, you're going to get a different impression of whether the vaccine worked or not. If there weren't going to be any cases in any case, the vaccine appears to work very well. If you were going to have a total epidemic where pretty much everybody catches it and only half of the population catches it, it still looks like the vaccine doesn't work. So our model is that we are going to divide people into different groups according to what kinds of treatment they get. In the simplest case, we have a single vaccine, and we compare that to not getting the vaccine. A more realistic case in the modern age for most diseases, such as influenza or the measles, if we had a new vaccine, we wouldn't compare it to no vaccine. Instead, we would compare it to the current state of the art. And in the case of something like COVID, where we have no vaccine, but we desperately want one, we probably don't compare one vaccine to no vaccine at a time. Instead, we want to run a trial in which we have many vaccines that we're trying. And then finally, there is the moral problem of the no vaccine case, which is if we really think the vaccine's going to work and we separate out some people and don't give it to them, is that really an ethical, a moral thing to do? So the scientific side of this can be quite difficult. But let's look at the simplest case, we have a vaccine. Maybe it's for something like flu, which is really annoying and to some segments of the population quite dangerous, especially the elderly, but also to people who are otherwise immunocompromised, such as people with AIDS or people who have had heart transplants and that kind of thing. So we want to get a vaccine, but we're not really hurting somebody who is willing to volunteer to not take the vaccine as long as they're pretty healthy to start with. People get the flu all the time. Maybe they don't have to stay away from work or not go to school, but it's usually not a big deal for young, middle-aged, healthy people. So let's think of that case. We've got our volunteers. They're either they're public-spirited people, and they're willing to participate in this vaccine test. Then we have a number of groups. We label them with an index 1, 2, 3, etc., and the generic is I. And so the people who are in group I who get sick is a random variable XI. It has support between 0 and 1 because it's a proportion, it's a fraction of a total, and it has a continuous distribution with some density that depends on conditions that we don't know about. The cumulative distribution is the probability that XI is less than some fixed number X. We can think of the density as the probability that XI is equal to X, although we know that's not quite right. Now, if we know these distributions Fi for various groups I, then we can do comparisons for the experiment and predict the likelihood of an epidemic if the vaccine is used compared to if the vaccine is not used. And so we'd like to know these distributions. Finding out the distributions is an estimation problem, and an estimation problem is one kind of inference problem. So how do we go about estimating a distribution? Remember, a distribution has a probability for every number between 0 and 1 in this case. But there's an infinite number. We can smooth and interpolate with an empirical histogram, but to be close to that, we'd have a lot of numbers. Another thing we can do is pick an event such as the states omega, such that the proportion is less than 0.2, and estimate the probability. We could take a statistic such as the expected value, the average of xi over the distribution, and try to estimate that. And the approaches, these approaches are called non-parametric estimation because we haven't said anything about the distribution yet. An alternative is to specify a parametric form for Fi, that is a formula with some parameters in it, and try to figure out what the parameters are. This is called parametric estimation. A very common parametric form is a normal distribution N of mu and sigma squared. Our problem is to guess or estimate mu and sigma squared. So now, let's look at the Sabin vaccine experiments. Polio, which is also called infantile paralysis, meaning paralysis of children, is a dreaded disease that used to break out frequently in epidemics. It frequently affected children. It caused partial or complete paralysis in some cases. And that complete paralysis would prevent breathing, which results in death, of course. Back in those days, we had very poor ventilator technology, and we used these big machines, which might remind you sort of a CAT scan or MRI machine today, which encapsulates the whole body, called the iron lung. But of course, those were very expensive, and many people would die anyway. Now, there were two approaches proposed to testing the vaccine. And remember, this is a problem, this is a difficult thing to do because the polio vaccine was very volatile. Sometimes it would have an epidemic, sometimes it wouldn't. And so we need lots of data to be fairly confident. Furthermore, in any given year, there would be an epidemic or not. So it was a sort of seasonal disease. And so what that meant was that they not only needed to test lots of people, but they had to test several years. So here was the approaches that were proposed. First, we would select millions of children from schools. The reason for millions of children is that they could do this all over the United States. And so even in a given year, you would expect that some places would have large outbreaks, other places would have small outbreaks, and you could use that information to somewhat remove the epidemic variability because you could see what the epidemics were across the country. So the first approach is to select millions of children from schools of grades 1, 2, and 3. You assign first and second and third grade students as the test group. They get the vaccine, and grade 2 as a control. They get a treatment, which is a placebo. So they injected something like salt solution or something like that, so that the group thought they were being, didn't know they were not being treated. And because of the ethical problem that it was not known for sure that the vaccine was safe, they asked the parents of the test group for permission, and if the child was not allowed to participate in the vaccine trial, they would be put into the control group so that we could get data on that child as well as others, despite the fact that they weren't permitted to be in the test group. And so that's why the first and third grade students were assigned as test and only the second grade as control, because they expected lots of people to say, no, I don't want you experimenting on my children. And those parents would take their children out and they would end up in the control. And so this would end up with a relatively balanced number of test group and control group. The second approach that was proposed was to select millions of children from the schools of grades 1, 2, and 3, ask parents for permission. If permission was allowed, randomly assign the child either to the test group or to the control group. If the parents did not give permission, exclude them from the trial. The people who proposed the first approach said, "Why are you throwing away all this data?" In our approach, we get data on millions more children than you do. And we'll see later that the second approach is a better approach. Now, with millions of students, the law of large numbers suggests that the results, the fractions of children in each group which contract polio, should be the same. These tests were being done at the same time. The first approach estimated that the vaccine was effective, but only about 10% significance. You could say that there's about a 10% chance that the experiment could have resulted in a no effect judgment. In fact, it was worse than that. Approach two estimated that the vaccine was effective at about 0.5% significance. Significance means, suppose that there was actually no effect, but you get the result that it seems to be effective. Okay, so this is a false positive. The significance measures the chance of a false positive. The chance of a false negative turns out to be quite a bit higher. And in the case of approach one was about 50%. Given what we later decided were the correct probabilities, the correct distributions for the result of the polio vaccine. The second approach turned out to have a probability of almost 50% that the vaccine would be judged ineffective, whereas the second approach had only about a 5% chance of that. Now, the vaccination for polio has saved millions of children from contracting the disease, hundreds of thousands from paralysis, and many thousands of lives. A 50% chance of not using the vaccine, even though it was effective, is really frightening. Why was there a difference? The important part is that the parents helped to choose whether the child would get the vaccine in approach one, which allowed hidden effects to interfere with the experiment results. In approach two, the children were first given permission or not, and the child was randomly assigned to whether the they would get the vaccine or the placebo, the treatment that seems to be a treatment but actually has no medical effect. What this means is that according to the law of large numbers, the hidden effects are the same for the tests and the control groups. Whatever the parents may be doing to make their children more or less susceptible to the vaccine, to being protected by the vaccine, it's going to be the same for the test group as the control group, because about half of the children are, for any given kind of parent, are being assigned to each group. So what is the hidden effect that caused such a big difference between experiment one and experiment two? Well, it turns out that some parents are rich and some parents are poor. And there are two direct effects on the experiment from this. Poor parents are much less likely to permit vaccination. They have a somewhat justifiable fear that the government is using poor kids as experimental animals for their tests. Rich parents tend to trust the government, partly because they are better informed about what the government does and doesn't do, and partly because they also have political power. Or at least they see their political preferences reflected in government behavior more often. The hidden factors are that very young children, less than 18 months, inherit polio immunity from their mothers. There's a sort of herd immunity because most people are affected, or most people were exposed to polio in those days. And so even if a mother didn't catch polio, there was always polio around, and so their bodies would react to the virus. And it turns out that in many cases, people's bodies would react quickly enough that they would build up immunity even though they had not caught the virus, they had not caught polio. The second factor is that poliovirus proliferates in dirty environments. So what was happening, the indirect hidden effect, is that poor children are exposed to the virus because they live in relatively dirty environments. But they don't get sick because of the inherited immunity. For 18 months, they're protected. Nevertheless, there's polio around them, and their body learns about this and develops immunity, even though they've inherited some from their mothers. So the virus stimulates their bodies to develop their own lifelong immunity to polio. And so poor children tend to be quite immune to the virus, even without vaccine. Rich children are relatively weak against the virus, even with the vaccine. So if we follow this effect through these experiments. In approach one, there's a very high proportion of poor children in the control group, which is believed to be high risk because it's not vaccinated, making this group much less likely to contract polio than the general population without vaccination. There is a very low proportion of poor children in the test group, which is believed to be low risk, making this group much more likely to contract polio than the general population if vaccinated. The difference in rates of contracting polio between the unvaccinated group and the vaccinated group, while it turned out to be positive in this actual test, was much smaller than in the general population. In approach two, these effects are absent because the randomness with such large numbers guarantees that the fraction of poor children versus rich children in each group is the same as in the general population. So sampling technique is critical in getting accurate results. And here, what is this saying about our statistical model? Our domain model is very simple. If you are unvaccinated, you have a certain probability of getting polio. If you are vaccinated, you have a different probability of getting polio. These probabilities are affected by factors that we don't understand. There are unknown variables, missing variables in our model. And this is something that we didn't find out, the facts about the prevalence of polio in the environment of rich kids and poor kids was something we didn't find out for many years after the Sabin experiments. So we couldn't know. It wasn't a problem that there was data available that we didn't use. We simply didn't have the data. We didn't have the model. We didn't know the variables. How can you deal with that? Very simple. You use a randomized experiment design when you can. If you randomly put the sample into different groups where you can control the treatment, then you have also effectively controlled the hidden variables, the unknown variables, as long as your sample size is big enough. What does big enough mean in this context? It means big enough that the law of large numbers applies for all of the subgroups that affect the probability. So here, we probably didn't need millions of children because the real important effect was just rich versus poor. So there are basically two groups, and if you want to be sure of getting things right in two groups, then you don't need that big a sample. But suppose that many, many different factors affected things, that very high-income people had different environment from medium-high, and those have a different environment from medium, and so on. Plus, it matters where your father works, and it matters, it might even matter what your race is, it might matter what your gender is, and now we're suddenly proliferating groups like crazy. In order to get that right, we need to get each factor distributed evenly across the groups, and for law of large numbers to work, each factor's population has to be large enough to be affected by the law of large numbers and average out with half and half in each group. Finally, I want to conclude with a list of a number of different types of inference problem. We've already seen the point estimation, which is the best guess of the value of a particular parameter. In this case, we wanted a guess at the parameter, the difference between the probability of getting polio with vaccination and without vaccination. Another kind of inference problem is called interval estimation. The point estimate in general is going to be wrong in the sense that the actual value is going to be different from it. However, we want to also have a way of talking about, well, it's close enough. And the way we do that is by giving limits between the lowest value we think is likely and the highest value we think is likely. And so we talk about something called a 90% confidence interval. This means that we believe that there's a likelihood of 90% that the true value of the parameter is between the lower estimate and the higher estimate. We have something called hypothesis testing. The significance value is a particular kind of hypothesis test. And in particular, we have some kind of effect that we're looking at. So in the polio case, we look at the difference between the probability of getting polio if you're vaccinated and the probability if you don't. If that is zero, there's no effect, right? So we want to know if the estimated value of the difference is much different from zero, enough different from zero to say that there really is an effect. So how do we do this? Well, we figure out a distribution and we say if the distribution, given that the actual effect is zero, gives us a probability of 5% or less that the value is this big, then we are going to be willing to bet at 20-to-1 odds in our favor, 20-to-1 odds in our favor, that it's not zero. And in the case of the polio vaccination, if you have a negative effect, right, that the fraction of people who get polio with the vaccine minus the fraction of people who get it without the vaccine is negative, then that's a good effect. That's lowered the probability of getting polio. And we want to say the odds are 20-to-1 or better that that happened. Then in that case, we can say, okay, well, even if there are some adverse effects, and there are almost always side effects of medications, in the case of a vaccine, the side effect could be very bad because there's always a potential with a vaccine that the side effect is that you actually catch the disease. We also know that there is another kind of side effect that occurs occasionally with vaccines called the overreaction, or perhaps you've heard of a cytokine storm in relation to the COVID virus. This is where the body's immune system overreacts and starts to fight itself, right? So we know about these autoimmune reactions where the body starts to try to kill itself because it thinks that it is, some part of the body is actually an infection of some kind. And a virus, a vaccine, can trigger such effects sometimes. It doesn't usually happen, and some people are more susceptible than others, but you have to worry about it. But if the odds are 20-to-1 that people are going to be helped by this vaccine, and the odds of an adverse effect from previous testing seem to be 1 in 1 million or 1 in 100,000, doesn't that seem like a good bet? We can never be sure, but I think that's a bet worth taking, and so does every public health authority in the world. Another kind of inference problem is predicting, guessing what X will be in a specific conditions, and specifically in the future. But Also, if we can do controlled experiments, we would like our model to predict what our variable will be measured as under the controlled conditions. We can look at multivariate distributions. Regressions are one way of handling these, where the distribution of the policy variable, such as the number of people who get sick, depends in a statistical way on other variables, such as income, or perhaps some measure of public cleanliness, which would be a correlation analysis. In regression analysis, we have the distribution of the policy variable depending on the other variables in a functional way, not just a statistical correlation, but a particular equation, a particular formula that predicts it. And finally, there's a technique called factor analysis, which is often used in data mining to extract correlations with a small number of underlying factors, often interpreted as causal variables.